Welcome to Commons Conversations, a series of interviews with campaigners sharing their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, radical history, and more. The podcast is produced by the Commons Social Change Library, a website containing over 1,000 resources for campaigners, which can be accessed for free at commonslibrary.org. The library contains many other podcasts, including other episodes in the Commons Conversation series. In today's episode, environmental justice activist Radhika Javari is interviewed by Kenzie Harris, the Principal Coordinator for the Global Grassroots Support Network, or GGSN. Radhika is the GGSN Coordinator for India, a member of the youth-based collective Let India Breathe, and the founder of Pantry Nook, a zero-waste, plastic-free food packaging company. In the interview, Radhika discusses how the campaign to protect RA, a forest within the suburbs of Mumbai, brought together a coalition of urban and indigenous communities from the mid to late 2010s. In doing so, she describes how this gave rise to new ways of campaigning in India, as well as the advantages and pitfalls involved in broad coalitions. Amongst other topics, the interview also explores the importance of long-term visions within social change work and ways in which current campaigns supporting Palestine are providing a lead for global solidarity more generally.
Thanks, Radhika, for being here. Can you tell the listeners a bit about who you are, what you do, and how you got into this work?
With regards to the environmental space, I've been in the space since 2017. My involvement started with the Save RA movement. So for people who don't know, RA is a forest in Mumbai, and it's a last remaining sort of a urban forest in the entire country. And it's got leopards and it's got a lot of Schedule 3 species. So Schedule 3 species are the ones that are, you know, the ones that enjoy the highest amount of protection under the Indian laws. And the forest is filled with them. A lot of Schedule 3 birds, leopards, so on and so forth. And that forest is being eyed by a lot of politicians, a lot of builders, real estate nexuses, and they want to chop it all down and, you know, extend the city even further. One of the ways that they were trying to do that was by changing some laws, because the forest is sort of protected. It has protection under Indian laws. So they were trying to remove the protection and then open up the land for further, you know, city expansion. This is a forest that my father took me to when I was young, because I've grown up there in Mumbai. And we used to go there when I was very young. And beautiful, beautiful place. Because of that nostalgic memories, when I heard that it was going to get chopped down, it was a massive, you know, a cosmic wrong to chop down a forest. And so I got involved with a citizens movement that started in 2014. It had already started, and I joined them in 2017. One thing led to another, and I guess the movement is still going on. Actually, the forest is still not safe. My involvement has sort of now become larger than just the Save RA movement, because through the RA movement, I got to know about many other such forests across India that are getting chopped down, unfortunately. And that is where I'm working now, trying to protect all the forests everywhere, all over the country. Not just the forest, obviously. It's not only about forests. It's about rivers, wetlands, oceans, everything, because the destruction is everywhere. So the movement to protect the environment is also everywhere.
Thanks for that. That's a big task. There's a lot of rivers and a lot of land and a lot of forest to protect. I'd love to know, of the projects and campaigns that you've been involved with over these years, which one are you the most proud of?
I guess all of them are very difficult to say. Pick one, right? I mean, they're all important. And unfortunately, we don't really see success that much with these kind of movements, because the forces that we are fighting are not, they're so big, right? The machinery that we are up against is so big, and it's not just national, it's global. There are movements in India like the Narmada Bachao Andolan. So Narmada Bachao Andolan started some 30, 40 years ago, and it is still going on. It is about a river. Narmada is a river in India, a very big river. They wanted to build a series of dams on the entire river, and it would cause a lot of displacement. A lot of forest would be submerged because of the dam, and the people who fought for that and who are still fighting for that, they brought the World Bank to its knees. They took up the World Bank because the project was funded by the World Bank. And 40 years since, they have not seen a success, and it is still going on. So most of the movements are like that in India. There is this another movement in Odisha. It's another state. The state has a lot of mineral resources, and it is continuously mined. And the tribal people there in Odisha have been fighting for 40, 50 years now, continuously, one company after another, after another. They see success, like the Niyamgiri struggle that happened in Odisha. This was 20 years ago, I think. They took over a mining giant. The company is called Vedanta. They took them to the court, and they won. They pushed the company out. And for some time, it was like as if they had won. And now the company is back again, trying to enter again, trying to mine again. And the fight has started all over again. So that is how it is. What I'm trying to say is that proud to be fighting at all.
Yeah, these are big systems and there's big players, and I think, like you said, this is global, and there's so much to tackle. It seems that the work never ends. I would be curious what kind of groups a campaign is comprised of, or the campaigns that you've been involved in, because certainly a question that comes up a lot in our communities is how do we make collaboration happen? So I wonder, are people who are involved in a campaign against trying to save the forest, is that, all people who would identify as environmentalists or activists, or are they made up of different groups? So what does that look like, and how do you think, if there are different groups, how do you think that collaboration happens effectively?
We saw this in the RA movement, where a wide variety of people collaborated. So RA has a tribal population of around 30,000 or something. So you have that faction who is interested in safeguarding the forest because their entire livelihood and everything depends on it. And also because they are so connected with the forest, right? Their gods and everything hail from the forest. So that is that aspect, and they're fighting all over the country. So and they've been fighting for such a long time. But the RA movement was the first time that saw a urban citizenry stand up for a forest. That has not really happened before. The urban middle class coming out and saying that, okay, we are not going to allow you to cut and chop down the forest. So that is something that happened for the first time. And I think it happened because, again, these were all youngsters, and they are aware of the climate crisis, and their awareness may not be in depth, but in the periphery, at a superficial level, they do understand that there is a climate crisis, and the reason behind the crisis is environmental degradation and environmental de destruction. And in order to stop the crisis, we need to stop the destruction. They've managed to make that link that between destruction and cause and effect. And they've also understood that by itself, on its own, no government anywhere can be trusted to do what needs to be done. And it is only through citizen pressure that a government will act. And that sort of made them come out on the streets for the very first time. It has never happened before in India. And that happened. And these were the people who do not identify themselves and do not call themselves environmental activists. And they came, and when we spoke to them, and we would meet every day, we would meet new people joining the movement. And they would say that, no, I don't really want anything. I don't really care about anything. I just want them to not chop the forest. That is all I want. I don't want to know anything. I don't want to talk about anything. I don't want fame. I don't want this. I don't want that. I just want that they not chop down the forest. This is it. So it was a very sort of simple idea that brought them out, that we need the forest and it should not be cut. So that is something that we saw in the RA movement, and that is something that is now getting replicated sort of all over the country, where you're seeing urban people who live in cities that were built on forest land come out and say that, okay, you know what, you did it once, and okay, I was too young or I didn't know at that time or whatever, but now we know better, and this needs to stop. This sort of a developmental model needs to stop. We can no longer afford to chop any more forest down to build cities or ports or factories, or it doesn't matter. But we just cannot afford to lose any more forests. So that sort of a voice is now increasing, and we are seeing that the people who are coming out are from everywhere. They are upper class, they are upper middle class, they are middle class, they are teachers, they are doctors, they are architects, they are working class. So everybody, they hail from all over the society. And the collaboration really was not really hard, because once you've decided that this is the most basic common minimal thing that everybody wants, everybody desires, and everything else just sort of fell into place. Our movement, again, going back to that, is a very good example. It's a very good case study, since since it happened for the first time. So usually what has been happening in India is urban middle class is not the one that stands up for the country's rivers or its forests. It's usually the Adivasis, the indigenous people, who stand up. So even in the Odisha case that I mentioned, the Niyamgiri fight that happened, it happened between a corporation, which is Vedanta, and the tribal group there. Even the Chipko movement that happened, which happened in the Himalayan region, that was also something that happened between the timber industry and the indigenous people, the mostly women who were trying to protect the forest. So that has been the history, environmental history in India. But now, after the RA movement, which happened in 2014, started in 2014, you're now seeing a different kind of people get involved. So when the RA movement was going on, we had different groups. So there was a doctor group that was speaking about the effects of air pollution on our lungs and our kids, and there are on pregnancies, and it's affecting everybody because the pollution is so bad. And you chopping down a forest is only going to make things worse. So, and then there was an architect group that was coming out and arguing that, you know, they were arguing about urban planning and city planning and how too much concretization is also, you know, is just not a very smart way of designing a city. So that conversation happened. A better, there were transport experts who came out and said that, okay, you know, this is not how you should be planning a city's transport. You should not be having car-centric approaches. You should be having public transport. Why is public transport so important? Why the government should be spending so much money on public transport rather than, you know, promoting car-centric infrastructure and all of those things. So in India, right, largely because environmental movements have been led by farmers or Adivasi community, the tribal community, the reaction of the Indian government and bureaucracy has been very patronizing. It's been very patronizing that, oh, you are a villager or you're an Adivasi, you don't know anything. You're not sophisticated enough or educated enough to tell the government what the government should be doing. And that is something that shifted in the RA movement, because the people who were fighting back are people with advanced degrees, are architects, they are engineers, they are doctors. And the government was no longer able to use that argument that, oh, you don't understand what we are trying to do. That is the kind of a new collaboration, I think, if you want to use that word, that came out of the RN movement, and that is now continuing.
That's so amazing to hear about, and I feel like the listeners will probably have some questions too. I have a lot of questions because, well, there's a few things that really struck me. One is that it happened in 2014, I think you mentioned, and for a lot of us in the global north, we saw 2019 as sort of this like pivotal moment where people started to recognize that the climate crisis was an issue. One thing that I would definitely wonder is if there was, like, to use the official term, like a moment of the whirlwind or just like a political moment that convinced people that it was the time to take action. I wonder what was significant, if there was something significant about that time that led people who wouldn't have otherwise ever taken action to wanna do something.
We 100%. So 2019 is when so movement for RA started in 2014. But 5 years down the line, in 2019, we saw massive protests. So there were protests, sporadic protests throughout the 5 year period. But in 2019, we had three things happen. The Amazon fires happened. Greta Thunberg happened. And otherwise, overall news surrounding the climate crisis went up. The flooding and, you know, the forest fires and this and that. And all of that sort of came all at once. All this information sort of happened all at once. And that resulted in snowballing of the protests. So we had like one of the protests, we had around 7,000, 8,000 people turn up. And these are not, like I said, Adivasis or tribal people. These are urban people who do 9-to-5 jobs, who don't ever participate in protests. They want nothing to do with protests. They just want to get up in the morning, go do their jobs, pay their taxes, and live their life, you know, without any, without messing around with powers, political powers. And yet this was the crowd that came. I would say that the global events, particularly the Amazon fires and Greta Thunberg, is something that propelled things here locally in Mumbai.
Something else that I thought was interesting about what you said is something along the lines of that, like, everybody saw this central issue and it just kind of, it wasn't hard to have people collaborate on it, that people just came together around one central issue. And something that I think happens a lot, at least where I'm based in SoCo, Canada, is that there's a lot of infighting related to, you know, people want to take an intersectional approach. And so if somebody says something that's homophobic or any sort of thing that's problematic, they're shut out and excluded, and there's not a lot of room for learning. And it's kind of like everybody has to agree on everything or nobody moves at all. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if that's even an issue at all in the movement spaces that you're a part of, or just if you have advice for others who might be in a situation like that, because it really hinders a lot of action and takes a lot of energy too.
Yeah, no, that is true. And that is there. There is no denying it. It's there. Is there. But I suppose what happened differently in the RA case specifically was that there was this a group, sort of a central group, that tried to keep the messaging very clear. And every time there was a disagreement, and because there are so many WhatsApp groups and so many Facebook communities, forums, where all these discussions are happening and everybody's coming and everybody's arguing and discussing and whatever. So there were always these moderators, right, for WhatsApp groups, or wherever all these communities are coming and engaging. And the messaging was very clear that you and I agree that this forest needs to be saved from getting chopped down. And whatever disagreements we have, let's keep that aside for now. We will figure that out later. But for now, this is what needs to happen if we want to save the forest, and let's just concentrate on that. And that sort of, I think, worked, to just constantly keep reminding people why they are there. Why have they assembled? Why have they come together? What is the motive or the motivation? And the motivation here is to protect the forest, and just let's just concentrate on that. So that is part of the reason why we had in the RA movement, the only environmental movement that I know of in India, where there were both left and right political ideologies working together amongst the supporters. I don't know any other movement where that has happened in India. And yet it happened. And it's just, you know that overall ideologically, you may not agree with the other person, but just, avoid that conversation. Don't have that conversation. I'm not saying that is something that needs to happen. I'm saying that is what happened. And that is what worked in this case, this specific case, localized case. But then again, these kind of, if this is the basis on which you come together, then it has a pitfall, in my opinion. And the pitfall is that the movement becomes restricted to that local issue, and it will not grow. And that is what happened with RA. It did not grow. It did not grow beyond the RA issue. It did not become like a national environmental sort of movement. It did not. And it also fizzled out after a point. It is still going on. There's still people fighting, but the momentum was lost. I mean, it's too much to expect for a momentum to last 10 years. It lasted for 10 years. That is a very big deal, very big achievement in itself. But then, yeah, there are ideological divides. There were ideological divides. There still are ideological divides amongst the people who support the cause. But for that particular cause, they've been able to sort of bench those disagreements and just concentrate on the issue. So that is something that worked. I don't know if it would work in other areas with other causes, other issues. I'm sure there are other ways, better ways of dealing with disagreements. But what I do know is if we are unable to overcome our differences and make room for people who we may not always agree with, then we may not find the strength that we require to fight this. We have to learn how to work together.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, that's so interesting. I can't even imagine, like, in this context, what a movement that has people joining from the right, the far right, and the far left would look like. So that's so interesting. I think this will raise a lot of reflections for people listening about, you know, I think you just shared a lot of lessons and things to consider. So I think you touched a little bit on this. I don't know if there's any other that come to mind, but so if there's any particular campaigns or initiatives or even approaches to taking action that are really inspiring or exciting you?
Right now, I think there's nothing going on in the world that is more impressive than the Free Palestine movement. Mm. That is beyond inspirational. That is one thing that since the past, how many days has it been? 66, 67 days? This is the third month now. It has entered the third month. And every single day is a day that gives hope. Despite the carnage and despite the massacre that is going on there, the way that the entire world has stood up, and every single day people are out protesting. Every single day. Nobody's forgotten. Nobody's willing to let go. Nobody's backing down. I can't think of anything more inspirational than that. I was not expecting it, at least not at this scale. And I did not expect it to last as long as it has lasted. And even after 30 days, 45 days, I kept worrying that people will stop protesting. But they haven't. And the protests are just, even now, they are just increasing in tempo and the sheer size.
Yeah. And it's starting to work. Power is starting to cede to this. Where I'm based in SoCal, Canada, we finally agreed to a ceasefire, the UN resolution to vote for that. So it's doing something.
Yeah, even India voted for the resolution, thankfully. So India has been a supporter of Palestinians since the very beginning, because India got independence in 1947 and the Palestinian issue started in 1948. And since that time, the government here and the people of India have stood with the Palestinian people, something I'm extremely proud of. And unfortunately, the current government is not following in the footsteps of their predecessors, but thankfully it voted in favor of the resolution. And yeah, that is only because of the international pressure.
Yeah. And I mean, this relates a lot to what I was hoping to discuss with you next, which is just, you know, what does global solidarity look like and how we actually make it happen in practice? I don't know if you have other examples to turn to, but we can certainly continue talking about Palestine as well.
This, I mean, yeah, right now I cannot think of a better example of global solidarity, right? I mean, I didn't even know it was possible to do this the way the Palestinian movement is going on, global movement is going on. I never in my dreams would have thought that this is possible. And the way this is happening has been led by young people, it just increases the hope even for the climate movement, because this is exactly the kind of solidarity we're going to need when it comes to tackling the climate crisis. So if we are able to do this for Palestine, and if we are able to cross all barriers, the racial barriers, geographical barriers, class barriers, all of these barriers, if we are able to overcome and come together for this cause, then we are 100% we're going to come together for the climate crisis as well. It's not just about fighting for Palestine. The movement is actually challenging the entire colonial structure, the imperial structure, that, you know, the institutions, the banks, the companies, the corporations. It's we're putting everything on the stand. We're challenging all of it, which is something that makes this very important. And how it turns out, which way it goes, will determine a lot of the future politics, global politics that will happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's been so incredible to watch. And I do think that we're in a paradigm shift where I think there will be new possibilities after this. I certainly hope, but I would be surprised if there wasn't. And maybe that's a good thing to, you know, pick your brain a little bit about is what do you think would be possible after this? What do you think the climate movement hopefully could do differently this time in what could be a new political environment? What do you dream that could look like?
Dream, I mean, that dream is one that I think all of us share across the globe. The one where, you know, you have, I want to say clean energy, but I will not use the word clean energy because there is no such thing. But a world where your energy, we manage to reduce our energy requirements. We manage to use less and do more. A world where, you know, we shift out of a consumerist sort of a mindset and learn to live better with nature. That is something that is the dream. I know that we may not be able to get exactly what we have in our heads. That may not happen, but somewhere if we can come close to it.
Yeah, I agree. We certainly don't do this sort of dreaming work enough where we think about what it actually is that tangibly what it could look like and how we actually get there. It's a lot of pushing back against projects, and sometimes we forget to think about what it is that we're fighting for.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, it's so important to be able to dream this. I sometimes give these talks on climate politics, and the first question that I ask people is, what would you do with your time if you weren't required to work a 9-to-5 job for 40 years or 50 years of your lives? What does this world and what does this life look like? And more often than not, there are no answers because people don't know that they can imagine this, that they're even allowed to imagine something. That the current status quo and the current way of doing things is accepted at such a deep-rooted level that we've forgotten that we can actually question it. We can actually question the systems we've set up, and we can actually question the way we want to actually live our lives. And not working a 9-to-5 job till you die is one of the things you can question. It's something that people are not even realizing. So it is the status quo is just accepted as if it's some sort of a law of nature. This is something that I feel is imagining a better world, a different world, is so important. Unless and until we imagine it, we'll probably not fight for it.
Yeah, totally. What a fun exercise to think about.
It's incredible because the next question that I ask is, I write down the word wealth and I ask, what does this mean to you? And 99 out of 100 times the answer is money or some sort of, you know, monetary idea of wealth. And the answer is never clean air or clean water or hobbies or reading books or spending time with a loved one, walking in a park. These ideas have become disconnected with the word wealth. We don't think of these things as wealth. We only think of money as wealth. And part of the problem begins here. We just lost the value of what a good life looks like. A simple, but a good, healthy life looks like. This is an exercise that I feel we should be doing more often, and especially with younger people. At least in India, we see this, where youngsters are more enamored with sort of a consumerist, a highly industrial sort of a lifestyle. They see the Western countries and they think that this is what progress looks like and this is what everybody's lives must look like. And yet that is not true.
Yeah, that's really interesting too. You were saying that the younger generation seems to have more of that mindset. And that if I got you correctly there, it seems different here in the global north, or at least where I'm based in SoCal, Canada. So I guess I'd love to know a little bit more about why you think that is, and how that can be shifted, and maybe, what could be done in our technological age, where so many of us young people are connected on social media and things like that. Like, what could somebody here, a young person in the global north, do to help shift that narrative, or what do people in where you're based do to shift that narrative?
These are questions we are asking ourselves. So we see this with urban, there's a rural urban divide here, and it's a very stark divide. And this is a reaction that is born out of inequality. So rural kids, they see urban kids with their iPads, with their expensive cars, with foreign vacations, foreign destinations. A lot of this is being spread via Instagram, that kind of a lifestyle. And they see all this and they see that they don't have access to any. And then it's a very human, very natural reaction to want it. And then you see that everybody is, joining the race. Everybody wants a big house, a big bungalow. They see all these celebrities jet setting around the world in private planes. So someone like Priyanka Chopra, right? And she has a massive impact on young girls here in the country. And they see her traveling in a private jet all over the world, and they see that and they think that they also want that life. They also want to jet set, in private planes. And why should they not? And Priyanka Chopra is probably a very big example, but then there are others also. Otherwise, also the normal urban kids, the kind of lifestyles they lead, the language they speak, there is a lot of inequality there. And until unless that inequality goes away, this problem will not go away. It's not that the rural kids or the kids who want this, who are running after it, need to change. It's more about people who are consuming a lot, how they need to stop consuming as much as they are. And show off, they need to stop doing that kind, that culture of, that status building where you equate progress and development with the amount that you're consuming. This equation needs to be broken and it needs to be redefined, where and that needs to come from rich people, that needs to come from people who are leading these lifestyles. Unless and until that happens, the other mindset will not change. We have some people here who do this. So there's this actress, Dia Mirza. She's very famous in India, and she keeps on talking about. So she did this thing where we had the Priyanka Chopra wedding, that big thing that she did, and completely opposite to that was Dia Mirza, who had a very simple wedding. She didn't spend any money at all on her wedding dress, nothing, nothing, nothing. Very, very, very simple wedding. And she did that because she understands this, that the rich people need to tone down their lifestyles. And she talks a lot about it. So that kind of has a, it's a good influence. And whoever does follow her has that influence on them. So we have those kind of role models, and they're increasing. Every day you see new people coming. We have a very good train network in India, and a lot of people, mostly the ones coming from cities, have now started talking about, refusing, how they're refusing to fly using air travel, not using air travel, and using the train networks to travel instead, especially when the distance is short. So that is something that is happening. It's the influencer, I think, they're called in Gen Z lingo. These are the people who are influencing, actually influencing. They're growing. Every day it's growing. So hopefully we'll see a shift sometime in the next 5, 10 years in the overall narrative around how we are defining development, how we are defining progress.
Yeah, that's really interesting and really insightful, actually, because I think that for at least in the circles that I'm involved in, the consensus is that young people are progressive. And I think generally speaking, yes, we are a more progressive generation than the ones before us. That's true. But I do think that you're alluding to something important, which is that the narrative that development looks a certain way, it still exists. It is still very consumption based, and that consuming more does equate to being of higher value or higher status. So I think that's a universal theme no matter where you're living. And I think it is a difficult narrative to shift, but it's interesting that there are people who have obtained a lot of wealth that are working to shift that. And I think it's a difficult like challenge to consider, but I do wonder like how we put pressure on people who have accumulated wealth, or just pressure on power, to act differently or to force them to have to.
Yeah, that is the question we're gonna have to find answers to, right? Our generation. That is the big problem that we're gonna have to solve. I look up to and learn from the people leading these movements. There's so many of them, and they're doing such amazing work. Someone like Aisha, right, from Pakistan. But yeah, these young girls, you see them at leading the COP, the dialogue in COP, and it's incredible. And I look up to these guys, these young girls and boys, and hopefully they'll be able to come up with the answers that we have not been able to.
Yeah, it's a big strategic question, so we'll leave the listeners with that. Maybe it'll lead to some important reflections. Before we wrap up, I have a couple more questions. I'd be curious. I mean, it's tough work, and it sounds like you're working on a lot of different things, and you know, these fights, like you said, are not easily won, and sometimes not often won. So what sustains you in this work, you personally?
I wouldn't say there's anything that sustains me. I think it's more of a comes up and it goes down, the hope and the anxiety. One day it's good, or very hopeful. You see something happening somewhere and you're like, wow, this is so hopeful. And this is bringing me so much hope personally. And then the next day something else will happen and you'll be like, okay, and the whole thing is hopeless. There's nothing. We are all doomed and we are all going to die. And it's like that. So it comes and it goes. It has its moments. And there are moments where I feel like giving up. I feel like no matter what any one of us may do, none of us is going to be able to make any difference. So that is also a thought that keeps coming up. A large part of my struggle is to keep that thought away, to just bury it deep, deep, deep down inside and not pay attention to it. But there's one thing that I've come to realize recently, and due to the Palestinian struggle, is that if you lose hope, then you've lost. You've already lost. And hope is something that is a very revolutionary thing. You just hoping, even when there is, everything may seem hopeless, and even then continuing to hope, that has a different kind of power. Having that kind of a hope is just changes everything. It changes the whole equation. It just changes everything. And no matter how bad I feel, remembering this, keep on repeating this and keep on remembering this is something that works for me, and try to do every single time I feel down in the dumps.
Yeah, I mean, we're only human. It's there's a lot of emotions in these fights. So I think that's actually probably helpful for people to hear that these are normal feelings to have. So you have a lot of lessons, and I would be curious if there's one thing that you wish you knew when you started out.
I don't know. This is so much, right? The more time you spend, the more lessons you accumulate. But I suppose there's no alternative to learning, to self-learning. These are lessons you can only learn once you jump in and once you start participating. There are so many people who will tell you, you know, don't do this or don't expect this. But I'm not sure how many of us would accept that kind of advice, no matter who it comes from, unless and until we experience these things on our own, for ourselves, and draw our own lessons, you know, gain our own experience. There's no alternative to that, unfortunately. But having said that, I do think that one thing that we cannot have here is impatience. We should not be expecting immediate results. This is a fight that is going to last at least our entire lifetimes. I don't know what will happen after that. And every day that I am involved in these fights, I try to accept that fact and understand that, you know, the world doesn't just change overnight. It will require a lot of time, and we should not lose patience as we should not lose hope. But other than that, I think all other lessons have to be learned by ourselves. Just start doing things. Just participate. Listen.
Yeah, I like that. I like that message. So last question I've got for you is, because I know that a lot of listeners will be joining from the Global North or from regions that are, we're all affected by the climate crisis, but maybe less so, and less so certainly by the other forces, and certainly that are very, very privileged. And so I'd be curious if you have messages for people that are joining from some of those regions, from the Global North or specifically from sort of Western regions.
So what we see, what I'm noticing, the narrative, right, that comes out of the Global North is often limited to fossil fuels. If you come here to a country like India, which is sort of a production house for a global production house like China, you see that environmental degradation is a major aspect driving the climate crisis. And I'm not talking about fossil fuels. Just the textile industry alone has destroyed India's rivers like nothing you'll ever see anywhere. Clothes from Walmart or Target or M&S or any of these major corporations, you are sort of participating in a destruction of entire river ecosystems here in a country like India or Bangladesh. So, and it's not just environmental degradation, even the labor that goes into making these clothes, the cheap fashion, especially in a country like Bangladesh, you'll see it's extremely exploitative, extremely, extraordinarily exploitative. And these aspects of the climate crisis is something that gets talked about, absolutely does, but the focus is far too much on fossil fuels. And it should be, it has to be, it must be. But at the same time, we need to start talking about, in the same breath, about these, the other side of the climate crisis. That part is there. And I would actually encourage people, youngsters who are fighting in the Global North, to come and visit these countries and see the sites, see what goes on. Like every time you use plastic, right? A large portion of the plastic is made in countries like India. So we have these vast petrochem corridors all over the country, in Gujarat, in Tamil Nadu, in Maharashtra. And the areas are so critically polluted that not just human life, but absolutely no life is possible in these areas. It's unlivable. The condition is such, it is so polluted, so critically polluted, that there's no life here. Everything is dead. It is that bad. So every time you're using that plastic spoon or plastic cutlery, this is something, you know, this is the aspect, the other aspect of that consumeristic lifestyle. What happens behind the scenes? I was in Gujarat 2 years ago, and I was in Tamil Nadu and Gujarat, both places where there are vast petrochem corridors and refineries. It was very difficult to see the kind of pollution that is there, how badly it is polluted. I saw small kids playing in poisoned water. The water bodies are all poison. It's red in color, dark red in color. And I saw small kids jumping in the water. They're not realizing how bad, you know, the water is. I saw sites, housing societies built on toxic dumps where all the laborers work. Laborers that work in these factories, they live. It was horrendous. So I feel that this aspect of the climate crisis, that is feeding the climate crisis, right, is something that we need to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for that. You definitely did have messages that were really important and that need to be heard. And I definitely, definitely agree that it's nowhere near discussed as enough in the mainstream climate movement or certainly in the messages that are coming from the West. So it's really appreciated to hear from you on that and on everything else that you shared today.
You've been listening to Commons Conversations, produced by the Commons Social Change Library, a website containing over 1,000 resources for campaigners, all of which can be accessed for free at commonslibrary.org.